Group meeting, Sunday, 5th July, 1981. The question is, does the word effort, in its profoundest sense, have any validity in the religious life? I'll read the question again. Does the word effort, in its profoundest sense, have any validity in the religious life? Now, of course, the very first question which rises up in association with that is, first of all, we must know what do we mean by the religious life? Is it an opposite to the secular life? Or is it so unrelated to the secular life that our ordinary everyday life does not come into consideration at all? Or is it in fact the secular life permeated throughout by religiousness inspired by the Spirit? Now, I think it is worthwhile getting this clearly in our minds. Is the religious life in actual fact the secular life permeated by religiousness inspired by the Spirit? And of course that immediately raises the question, what is religiousness? If we say it is permeated, if it's the secular life, we know. But if it is the secular life permeated by religiousness, what is religiousness? Now, in this connection, consider carefully the two contexts that we as we are and suffering from our shortcomings and so on, as far as we can think about this, we can look at it from the point of view of two contexts. One is, of course, the secular context itself. And the characteristics of this secular context, which we all experience, every single human being experiences it in his daily life, the characteristics are finitude, temporality, and mortality. These are absolute facts with regard to the secular context. The way we are constituted and the way in which we are conscious of ourselves and the world compels us to say that the world consists of things and persons which are finite, which are temporal, and which are mortal. Everything comes into being, grows, moves, expends its life, and passes away. Birth and death are the two extreme ends as such. That is the secular context. And then there is what we may call the religious context, the context of religion. We may call it the context of transcendence, which is characterized by the opposites of the characteristics of the secular context. Opposites only verbally. The religious context is infinite, eternal, immortal. We know the meaning of finitude well enough. What is the meaning of finitude? Something which we can measure, something which is limited, particular, cognizable, nameable, measurable, and so on. But what is the infinite? One thing we can know about it at once, it is immeasurable. The idea of immeasurability is involved in it. But it is not merely immeasurable, it is not immeasurable merely in the sense of finding out the size of the thing in terms of distances, weights, and so on. It is immeasurable in an extraordinary way, which is quite outside the secular meaning of the word measurable. So, the religious context, the transcendent context, is infinite. It is eternal. Again, eternal, not the opposite of the temporal. It completely subsumes the temporal. Ordinary time as we know it, time by the clock, and psychological time, time which we are aware of in terms of moods and the extent to which we can pay attention to what is happening. It also subsumes the timeless. It's very important to realize this, because through the ages, timelessness, both by philosophers and by religious people, has been identified with the eternal. But the timeless is not the eternal. The timeless has been postulated by those who can attend in that manner in which they are completely at one in mind and consciousness with that to which they are attending. Well, one enters that state at a certain moment of time, and one comes out of that state at another moment of time. In the flow of time, there is a state where the timeless is experienced by a living person. But it is not eternal. Don't try to measure eternity. It's a curious thing. If one awakes to the inner reality, that which we may call the absolutely real, one may thrill to a certain degree to this eternity, which involves, subsumes both time and the timeless. So that is another characteristic of the transcendent context as such, which we may postulate as a concept or so many words, and in so many words. And of course, that necessarily implies that it is immortal. There is no birth and death involved in that. Timelessness has a birth, it has a death. You begin experiencing timelessness when you are in that meditative condition, and you come out of that timelessness when you have finished experiencing that atonement, you see. You have to come out of it, because the bodily necessities, food, drink, elimination, etc., all that has to be fulfilled. Otherwise, if you don't, well, your timelessness will certainly merge into the eternal, and that there'll be no more you. you the distinct person here, you see. So, if we can understand this contrast of the secular context, finite, temporal, mortal, contrasted with the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. Bear in mind that the infinite, eternal and immortal completely subsumes the finite and the mortal. The finite and the mortal does not subsume the other. You see, this may sound like just so many words, playing with, juggling with ideas and juggling with words, but it isn't. This is something which becomes a matter of actual realization. Don't ask for any sort of logical proof of it. There is no logical proof possible here. You will find, for instance, in connection with this sort of matter or context, the Buddha saying again and again, the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, which is beyond reason. He says it again and again. Reason must be quiet. And reasoning, therefore, the process of reasoning, which is this movement of the mind, that has to become still. And in that stillness, the sense of the infinite, the eternal and the immortal becomes active. It's a sense which lies dormant in our own psychophysical constitution. If it wasn't already dormant in us, such things can never be realized. Nirvana, the kingdom of heaven, paradise, all these things would be meaningless. Now, the question arises about religiousness. The transformation of our secularity into pure religiousness, therefore, that is religious living, is the full and true meaning of our growth as human beings. We are not merely political, social, and economic animals. We are religious beings. And in my use of the word being, I am including living in a state of awareness of the truth, the ultimate reality, in a state of awareness. That is the real meaning of being. And that being is always creative being. So this transformation of our secularity into pure religiousness is the full and true meaning of our growth. From the moment we are born, the body certainly grows, we know that. Now, in addition to that, we have to grow out of our subhuman state into the perfect human state, the true human state. I use the word sub not pejoratively, but as a objective statement of actual fact. That which is not yet perfect, which has not yet come to full fruition, is in the sub-state, in a sufficiently undeveloped state to enable us to call it sub. So I mean subhuman in that sense, because the word human, as we have seen time and again, really means the happy, the blissful creator. And that is what we ascribe to God, to the Absolute, the blissful creator. You'll find this in all the great religions of the world. So if that is the true meaning of the word human, hu manas. Then we begin to get a glimpse of that towards which we are growing or should be growing. We can cooperate with the process of growth where that is concerned, or we can obstruct it. We obstruct it or cooperate with it, not only because of our own personal urge and desire and aspiration, but also because of the influence of the environment, the circumstance. If the environment is totally inimical to us, we will never wake up to anything like this at all, obviously. We will just live, go through life struggling, suffering, enjoying in our very subhuman sense of the term enjoyment, and die. That's all. And we know that growth necessitates change. But change of what sort? A change can be regressive. And especially in the world today, we see too much evidence, or a very great deal of evidence, of regressive change. Sometimes change is just fortuitous. It is not in tune, not in line with the fulfillment of the purpose of existence of that particular person or that particular animal or tree or whatever it is. But it has to be, particularly with us, a progressive change. And the difference between us and the animal world, we are an animal species anyway, but the difference between the animal species which we call the human species and all the other species is that the animal tends just unconsciously to be in line with the laws of its being, what we commonly call the laws of nature. But with us, being implies something very much more than just the simple laws of nature as such. There is the tremendous difference, the immeasurable difference caused through mind and consciousness. So, we must inquire, how can we change progressively? In order to change progressively, obviously we must have some idea or ideas, even if they are rather childish or jejune, rather narrow, to start with. Because the starting point is from no knowledge, from the position of ignorance. Now, progressive change will imply, therefore, that we must have some vision of the purpose of our existence. Or at least a general feel of the direction of change, the direction in which we are moving. That is to say, if we are really growing. Do remember that growth involves change. If there is a stoppage of the change, then there is no growth, there is fossilization. Look at the body itself. It's born, it's about that big, you see. It just lies on its back, kicks about a little bit, screams a lot, and all the rest of it. Now, if, as we see, that little living body changes from day to day, what is it, in the first month, it's three times its original weight, or something like that, isn't it?
First year.
Huh?
First year.
Sorry, thank you. Thank you. There spoke a mother who knows, and who remembers, let me say, because so many of you are mothers. Yes, in the first year, it has changed to that extent. So there is continuous change, otherwise there is no growth. And this applies also to our mental side, our psyche. We are, as we all know, psychophysical creatures. Psychophysical. We are not body and psyche. Do realize that. It's so difficult to be free of the illusion that the body is this and the psyche is something different. It isn't. This organism, this living organism, the existential being, the one whom we call, to whom we refer as this person or that person, is a psychophysical organism, totally, completely. Where does this psyche come from? It's very important to appreciate this point. Right up to modern times, people have always talked of mind. It's the Greeks who brought out the word psyche, but they didn't give any clear presentation of how the psyche comes into being. We have, through the millennia, people have talked of mind, but no one knows what mind is. What is the mind? Can you put it on a plate and present it to me? Or send it in a parcel? Have you ever seen a mind minus a body? There's no such thing. And you see, the very language we use, a mind, his mind, her mind, is a mistaken expression of the fact. Mind in itself is a universal energy. It is like space. It is characterless. Can you ascribe any character to space? Characteristics. Good, bad, indifferent, etc. You can't. Mind is like that. It's characterless, it's beginningless, endless. It belongs in actual fact to the transcendent context, to the context of primordial creative energy. Creative energy. It is that archetypal form. It's an archetypal form, universal, functioning at a cosmic level of this creative energy which releases cosmos out of chaos. That is its speciality, so to say. That is mind, which releases cosmos out of chaos. Enlightenment, wisdom out of ignorance and mere knowledge. That is mind. And it is universal. There is no such thing as my mind or your mind. It is something universal which is in all of us. Just like life is universal in all of us. And space is like that. It is universal, it is characterless. It's important to realize this. But this energy, and it's a real energy of an extremely subtle nature, which interacting with matter, our own body, for instance, gives rise to psyche. That energy interacting with this concretized primordial creative energy, especially through the mechanism of the brain and the nervous system and the activity of the ductus glands, gives rise to our particular separate mental processes. Mind is universal, psyche is particular. You and I each have psyche. We can talk of my psyche, the word representing what we commonly call our mental processes. But they are really psychical processes. Our thoughts, our feelings, our moods and all and so on, all that constitutes our psychical life as such. So we are psychophysical organisms, and do realize that psyche is not something separate or superior to body. In fact, it is completely rooted in the brain and nervous system and the activity of the ductus glands and so on. I mentioned the activity of the ductus glands particularly simply because that activity does display itself in so many of our characteristics. So many of the elements which make up our character and our thinking process, our feeling process, it's all associated with that. You know, if you feel certain emotions, there will be adrenaline discharged and so forth. And under certain circumstances, other ductus glands will be in operation. But we recognize those processes as if they were purely mental things. They are not. They are rooted in physical matter. That's what we must really see. I know it would be quite easy to say, oh, Firoz is an awful materialist. Yes, he is, but he's not an awful materialist. He is perhaps a good materialist. We have the wrong conception of matter. Matter as such is the most concrete expression of the supreme, utterly spiritual, primordial creative energy. It's the one and the same energy. We talk about a universe, we talk about universality, and we have very little idea of what universality means, implies, and how it is expressed in the total life of the whole universe. This unitary wholeness is something which is the peak point of realization in true human consciousness, this unitary wholeness. Now, the particular type of energy, archetypal form of this creative energy, which is universal, interacting with body, gives rise to psyche. So you see, there is a connection in mind and consciousness in ourselves between our being, our psychophysical being, and the transcendent itself. Transcendence resides in us, but it resides uncompellingly. All the lesser grades of expression of the primordial creative energy manifest as grosser and grosser forms, and finally what we commonly call solid, liquid, gaseous matter. As such, you see. Do you get the feel of it? It is not easy. It's really difficult because, you see, when we listen to words, we are constantly interpreting them in terms of what meaning we put upon them. And the conditioned brain and any person, the conditioned person, will necessarily restrict the actual richness of the meaning in terms of his conditioning. He thinks he will understand. Oh yes, I know, I understand, I see. We all say that quite easily. I've done it all my life myself, and I know now that it is simply due to egoism and vanity. I know. I don't know. Start from the beginning. I don't know. And you see, if it becomes a real thing in me that I don't know, what happens? The psyche is quiet and completely open to the influence of that which is beyond my psyche, beyond all the limitations of my own psyche. and therefore I can grow. This is not easy. This is quite difficult. We can discuss it some other time if you like, but we must go on now. So we see that now nature brings the body to fruition. Nature sees to all that, brings the body to maturity. But to bring the psyche to maturity is our particular responsibility. Nature doesn't do that. You see? So then the purpose of existence in terms of the human race and the human species is that this thing which functions as psyche in each one of us will free itself from all its limitations, become empty of all that obstructs true enlightenment and vision and so forth, and enable this universal energy, pure mind, to function quite freely through your brain and your whole psychophysical organism. That is one of the fundamental purposes of our human existence. And as and when that takes place and can take place, the individual psyche gets into tune with the universal cosmic expressions of the different forms in which creative energy functions. This has been told in the different mythologies of the world and in the systems which have presented archangels, angels, and so forth. Archangels are not mysterious, invisible birds flapping through the upper air. Not at all. Archangels represent actual energies in operation on the cosmic scale. That is what they are. When people have written or said that the Archangel Michael visited me or something, what they really mean is, perhaps they are talking like that quite innocently, not knowing that they are talking a bit nonsensically. What they really mean is that they happened to be in that state of psychical tranquility so that they were in touch with the cosmic expression of this primordial energy. And it manifests, it is recognized by us, by our brains, in terms of certain special qualities as such. And they are all our own qualities. If we see God, we misinterpret Him always in our image. That is a fact which we really must see, that will save us from a great deal of vain, egoistic nonsense. Now, the purity of the psyche is bound up with the way our senses function. It's the functioning of our senses which keeps us down in the mire if we do not understand. Because the psychophysical organism has a pleasure-pain mechanism with which it is endowed by nature. It is endowed with this mechanism by nature for its own safety. If we didn't have a pleasure-pain mechanism, we would just not know how to move in the world in which we are, and we could easily destroy ourselves. So, this pleasure-pain mechanism has its psychical counterpart, a pleasant sensation, and the psyche says, oh, I like that, I want more of it. And an unpleasant sensation, and the psyche says, no, I don't like this. I better get rid of it or I'll destroy it. So you get the roots of conflict arising between the two sets. The I want and I don't want. And the two are in conflict constantly. The I want is greed. The I don't want is violence, hate, and so forth. And these two forces are constantly in opposition to each other. Now the brain steps in here, like a fool, generally, and raises up all sorts of stupid ideas about what I should do about it. And if I take the trouble to look deeply into the activity of the brain, I will see that actually it is all the time working for its own pleasure. That is why the psyche can never transcend itself. It is rooted in the brain and the activities, the ordinary physiological activities which go on in the whole body. It is rooted in that. So the whole of the activity of the psychophysical organism, our thought, feeling, speaking and action, is interrelated and interactive with innermost consciousness. Now this is a very difficult point again to see clearly. We don't know what consciousness is. We never will know. Unless and until there is the fruition of complete enlightenment. Consciousness is this, again, like a mind, this universal something, transcendent something, which touches every human being. When the yogi talks of Shiva residing in the seventh chakra, the Sahasrara, that is what he's talking about. That consciousness touches you there. That doesn't mean that there is a bit of the supreme consciousness in us at all. It's the totality of consciousness. It's the totality of mind. It's the totality of transcendence which permeates us. But because the grossest material manifestation of this primordial creative energy has separate organs and separate parts, the idea of separation and so on operates very, very strongly in us and through us all our life. It's not easy to become free of that. So now our psychical functioning is not in harmony with consciousness. But our psychical functioning, whether mistaken or whether correct, interacts with consciousness. It makes an impress on consciousness. And consciousness, this pure thing which is in us, and mind you, that is the universe, that is a universal some energy in us, that constantly affects our thinking, feeling and so forth. According to what one's innermost consciousness is, not state of mind, remember. Consciousness is not a state of mind or feeling or anything. The innermost consciousness that there is in us determines what sort of thought, feeling, speech and action will be expressed through the psychophysical organism, which is you or me. And our psychical functioning not being in harmony with consciousness, because is not in harmony because psyche is seduced by pleasure lust. The lust for pleasure, for satisfaction. If we look carefully into ourselves, we are always seeking our personal satisfaction in some form or other. Sometimes in nice, highfalutin, exalted forms, serving God and being indispensable to the one who does not need us at all, really. And so on. So, fundamentally, life must satisfy me. The infinite transcendent must constrict itself into my mortal cup of clay. You see, hence the perpetual sort of conflict between the children of God, I'll use theistic language for the moment, between the children of God and the Father God. And we see that reflected even in ordinary family life. Children in conflict with the parent. Hence, I cannot live virtuously. That means, cannot live free of duality, conflict, confusion, and sorrow. This means that I cannot live religiously. Because if I live religiously, then I am free of conflict, duality, confusion, sorrow, and all these things. Why cannot psychophysicality not misbehave? Simply because the organism is descended from an animal ancestor. But with this peculiarity involved in this situation, not only is it descended from an animal ancestor and has all the animal qualities in it, but it also has this germ of divinity in it, the human species has. That is what makes the difference, that is what makes the conflict and the difficulty. We do have transcendence permeating us. The divine is our potentiality, dormant, hidden. And this divinity and the consequence of our animal origin pulls us in different directions at first. When we see what is happening and see quietly, and that is extremely difficult because the brain is so conditioned all the time that we see as through colored glasses and we don't see the truth easily. But by effort, by the right sort of effort to start with, we learn to let the whole organism become quiet. And when that critical point is reached, when the quietude comes to its fruition, then there is the state of enlightenment. And then effortlessly one lives the religious life. And there, effort has no validity. It's only in the material sphere that there is expenditure of energy which is not self-replenishing and not self-subsisting. Transcendentally, this creative energy is self-replenishing, self-subsisting. It is. This is the meaning of the Absolute. And if you look deeply enough into all the great religious teachings, you will find this hidden in the verbal expressions of the religious teachings. And you may ask, finally, what do we do about it? How do we get to this state? Watch. Watch and pray. Pray not meaning, dear God, please send me another £1,000 because my rates have gone up 5,000%. That's not praying. To pray means to be in communion. And therefore we can put it in the Buddha's terms, samasati, perfect watchfulness, perfect mindfulness, and samasati, and samadhi, the perfect communion.